We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green as People. I am your host, Kurt North, and today I have with me David Walker. David, how are you doing today?
I'm all right, mate. I've watched this episode many a times. I can probably recount the script at this point.
Many times. How many times do you think you've seen it then?
Well, I watched it the other day when we were scheduled to record. I watched it the morning before, and then I was going to watch it today, then remembered I had a cover shift at my other job, which is not the music job. And So basically I just put this on the laptop in work and just played it maybe about 6 or 7 times through, just in the background.
So it hasn't been like on repeat for the past 3 weeks or anything like that.
No. It's not been me staring at it 6 or 7 times. It just happens to have been on in the background.
Just to do the formalities, we are going to be talking about season 2, episode 7. That episode is 1919. It's written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong. It was directed by Thomas J. Wright. It was released on the 7th of November 1997, and this sees a busload of children kidnapped from their school by 2 kidnappers. The IMDb, have you had a look on IMDb at all, David?
I literally clicked on it then, but my internet connection has died.
Before it comes back on, what would you rate this episode out of 10 for you personally? And then we'll look at the IMDb score and discuss that.
Given I rated the last episode quite highly and was too tired to actually correct it and lower the mark somewhat, I would say this one is actually a 7 for me.
And what would you point to just in general? Why would you give it that sort of score?
I think the guest performances set it apart from a lot of the others. Namely, IMDb's gone. I can't remember the character name now. Who's Deadeyes, Captain Deadeyes. who kidnaps the kids? What's his name?
And Matthew Prine is the character, I think.
Yeah, that's the one.
Ironically, someone on Facebook or Twitter said that they thought it was actually Spike from Buffy, which is interesting. James Masters, yeah, they assumed it was James Masters, which. But I can see where they were coming from. Actually, I don't know if you could see the likeness of it. I can see a likeness to it.
Yeah, there is a bit of a vibe about him. He's got the 90s bad boy thing going on.
Yeah, with the short, spiky, blonde hair.
Yeah. And the don't take no orders leather jacket, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And what did you think about the storyline overall? What's your general thoughts on the storyline itself?
Yeah, I like it. Unlike some of the stuff in season 2, especially with Laura Means as such, a lot of the storylines just kind of go bonkers. And you sort of blink, and then there's angels on the screen. You're like, what happened? this one, the entire build-up of the episode leads to essentially a very important moment of what is probably divine intervention. And because of that, the ending is given so much weight. And I think, as a standalone piece, this is a really nice, solid, like, 45-minute piece of television that comes in, does its job very nicely, very efficiently, and leaves you at the end kind of going, ooh, that's impressive. That's good. Okay, I like that. Yeah.
Fantastic. I would give it a 7 as well. I think it's a good episode. It's not one of my favourites of the season, but it's a memorable one. It's one I remember quite well.
What kind of stuff is it that sort of... you basically, your question repeated towards you. What?
Yeah, so what... I do like the aspects of his internal logic and the way that he's kind of demonstrating, you know, like the World War III element, that things don't just start with wars, that there's a build-up to it. You know, I mean, this is pre-2001. We've got, obviously, the likes of Al-Qaeda. You know, September 11th just didn't happen on that date. You know, it was a build-up for many years. So I do like that aspect to it. Mm-hmm. I thought that the concept is quite good. I quite like the... the turnaround, as you say, at the end, I think it's an interesting little twist, mm-hmm. and it's playing on your assumptions that, you know, that he is all just evil and bad, and he's going to be he's kidnapping these girls, and you don't know the reasons for that, but the end kind of twists it. So I quite like those aspects, and I think it's good generally overall. Having Laramie's come in and doing a bit of a Seven kind of thing, kind of works quite well.
It's I think I quite like it when she turns up, although there is a little bit of like Poundland psychology involved, I would say.
So those are the reasons why I would give it a 7. IMDb scores it at 7.5. That's from 206 votes. Now, that rates it around about fifth from the bottom. It's joint fifth with Beware of the Dog. So would you put it down there if you were rating it in the season as a whole?
7.5 is near the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a damn good TV show if that's like the lowest.
I think that because Millennium's got such a cult following that there's not many people that have seen it. There's not many votes.
Yeah.
And some of the bigger episodes like Curse of Frank Black got 8.3, for example. And Jose Chung did really well, being a changeover from the X-Files. Midnight Century did well as well. So I don't think that the worst rated episode is something that we've already done, which was Single Blade of Grass. That was the worst.
Which one was Single Blade of Grass in 20 words or less?
Yeah, Single Blade of Grass. Frank goes to burial ground, finds and Buffalo running through the streets.
Oh yeah, yeah. Now I remember. Yeah, it's coming back to me now. Yeah,
Buffalo runs through the streets, and Frank Black and his gift. Then all of a sudden becomes a thing he's been waiting for it to become. Where he sees crows flying out the house and things like that. So it comes around that level. Other episodes, it kind of hovers around things like, let's have a look, Siren, which is the mysterious Asian woman who's linked to several strange deaths aboard a Chinese ship. And what else does it come near? Amnesis, which is the Catherine and Lara episode as well. So those are the kind of the episodes it's hanging around.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm going to say this is probably, maybe not one of the better episodes I've seen, but certainly one of the more enjoyable.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's even though it has links to the Fourth Horseman, especially at the end with the whole seven spirits and things like that, it is pretty much its own thing, and I think that's probably the reason why it's enjoyable from that point of view. I would agree with that, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so the cold open begins with pretty much a cacophony of news reports on a TV screen. Information of disasters are written on the floor of Prime's floor in the little, what would you call it, sort of caravan, as we would call it. I'm not sure what the Americans would call that, but there you go. And we've got all of these things happening on the floor, and the allusion to the seventh seal, which is alluding to John of Patmos, who receives apocalyptic visions in the Book of Revelation. What did you think of the cold open with this cacophony of information being fired at him and him writing everything on the floor and circling it round saying me? What did you think of that opening?
I thought it was very effective, but it does commit the absolute cardinal sin of, we've got 45 minutes, we need to show that this guy's crazy, put a load of TVs in one room, go. But the way that it builds, again, feels very dramatically building. Like when I was listening to it earlier, it kind of the sound would almost go off, and then it would just build up and build up and build up with these news reports. And what I like that it does is, even though it's got this complete wall of nonsense going on, is that you can, every time it cuts to a certain screen or a radio, you can pick out the key lines of dialogue from what is being said. So the information is still managing to get through to you somehow. And your character's reactions in the middle of the room, you know, he's kind of keying off stuff, and even though it is absolute chaos, it is weirdly structured, which I suppose is what he's doing in his head. He's structuring everything and writing it down. And what I thought about earlier was, Is ME like a symbol for Millennium of some description?
I don't know. That's certainly an interesting choice. And I noted in the beginning and the end that they put what I considered to be with the Polaroids an inverted question mark on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be beyond them to put these type of things into the show as well. I definitely think there's something to that.
Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned about it's pretty much the sound design, which I know which you're really into.
Mm-hmm.
So you did feel that came through kind of really clear with the news reports that they actually lifted it when they needed to, and we got the vocalization of everything. You were getting that clear. So you thought that was quite good.
Yeah. I thought it was it's really impressive. I don't think there's any of there's much score going in the back at this point, or not that I could pick out. Unless I really put my brain to the speaker. But yeah, it's all about just kind of information overload, details. And of course, when he goes outside, you get a bit of score come in, you get almost a breath of fresh air, which is, again, it's all lovely imagery tying in with sound design and the actor's performance. It's all really nice kind of dynamic work here.
No, I would definitely agree with that. A lot of music artists use that kind of thing as well. I mean, I know mm-hmm. that Muse and U2 have used that kind of thing before, where they throw information at you left, right and center, and
mm-hmm.
you know, it's designed to throw you off balance a little bit, to you know, so you're getting this wall of information coming at you all at once.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if we picked it out apart, you'd see all kinds of things that's written in there about various different things, which is obviously the link to the show. Once we come out the code open, there's a couple of things that I've noticed on here, where we've got Peter Watts who's talking to Frank in the car, and he basically says I have to believe that whatever happened here came from without rather than within the town itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that they used in Beware of the Dog as well, with the idea that the circle and the town folk in Beware of the Dog, that they want something encroaching into their land. It was almost like an evil invading their space.
Mm-hmm.
But they're using this kind of same element here, where they've used the theme of, you know, it had to come out from within. I don't believe it was the bus driver. I believe it had to be from somewhere further afield. Did you pick up on that? And what are your thoughts on Peter in this episode?
I mean, what he says kind of ties into, I think maybe in the first 20 minutes of this episode, a lot of people make mention of, is it an outsider? Is it someone inside? Is it international terrorism, domestic terrorism? They're trying to figure out kind of like basically where the person sits, almost on a map. And I'm probably not going to answer your question directly because I'm going way off track already.
It's all right.
But it's never really the answer to all these questions is never really settled, because he's the guy who's done the abducting is in like a little shack thing, and he's clearly outside of the town, but he's near the town, so surely people should know him. But at the same time, yeah, that question never feels like it is properly answered. There's no sort of Frank Black profiling moment where he says who he is.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
I would totally agree with that. I actually thought that on my last watch that he seems to be, as you say, just on the outskirts looking in, that you'd almost expect a normal, an average TV show to say it was an ex-pupil in the school, or was an ex-person from the village or from the town. But we get no indication about who he is and why he's there, even less from his partner, which is something I wanted to bring up. That we find absolutely nothing about him whatsoever. I don't even think we even know his name. I'm pretty sure that his name never gets mentioned. And all that we know is he's a pretty good shot with a rifle.
Yep.
I think that's it.
He's a pretty pretty good shot with a rifle, and ironically has done better for himself than most of the other supporting cast in this episode. So fair enough.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, so I think the dynamic of Peter, Lara and Frank work quite well towards the end of the episode.
Yes.
There's some aspects of Peter and the Millennium Group I want to pick up a bit later on as well, which I have some questions over and get your thoughts on.
Ooh.
But we do, yeah, we do, but we do get to the bus that's been ditched in the lake, and we come across Sheriff Casey. Now, what did you think of him? and his arc during the course of the episode. I know you've already mentioned how badly you hate Dead Letters, but there's an element of Dead Letters to this for me that it's a law enforcement person who's on the edge of going too far,
mm-hmm.
but also linking with what Frank did at the beginning and the end. So what did you think of Sheriff Casey's the actor's performance, but also the character itself?
I think the way that this is done more minimally than Afro Guy in Dead Letters, I think because it takes a bit of a backseat and it's a thing that's going on. It's like, oh, my daughter's missing. My daughter's been kidnapped. And because he's in law enforcement as well, small town sheriff. And he does lose his cool a few times, but it doesn't ever feel... Because with Dead Letters, the guy was just... As I said in the other podcast, when I refer back to it, it was... That guy was in the most depressing family barbecue I've ever seen. Like, Catherine is a... She is a strong woman, to put it with Frank and his friends. This one, everything felt like it was motivated.
Right, yeah.
Whereas... You know, in Dead Letters, you could hand the guy a cup of coffee and he'd just, like, sink into a dark pit of misery in a corner. Whereas this, every sort of action, reaction that the guy makes feels like it's got a bit of weight to it and it's justified, but as much as can be expected in a 45-minute turnaround.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Yeah. You never left a sort of... You don't go diving deep into his character, which you don't need to do. It just does what it needs to do, and it moves on. The dynamic between him and the guy who abducted his kids is there. It's present. Everything's done. It's nice and breezy, I think.
Yeah, that's fine. When we do actually come out of that scene and we first meet him, that we find out that he's got somebody on the bus and his daughter, and the line that I really like at this point is when Frank's going towards the bus and they say it's insanity to wish for a mass abduction, which it obviously is.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a scene where Frank touches Jessica Casey's bag, mm-hmm. and he receives the apocalyptic vision.
Yeah.
Did you think that was effective, and did you think that was pointing towards what Jessica would be during the course of the episode, or do you think it was just a touching moment for Frank to kind of get an idea of how it came about? But what I particularly like, and I don't know what your thoughts on this, was in the past, some of his gift might be that it would say, you know, what he needed to do or what the killer was thinking. But in this episode, it's just the idea of the apocalypse moving, but then straight away moves on and does a bit of investigation work where he sees the paint on the back door. So what did you think of that scene and him physically touching Jessica's bag and receiving that vision?
The fact that it essentially gave him the same vision that the episode opens with, that the guy gets when he has a eureka moment, he thinks he's finally figured it out, he gets the vision, and Frank essentially gets the same vision. It does more than a lot of the other episodes do in sort of connecting them, and it is kind of a bit more on the nose, sort of psychic, divine intervention-y than perhaps perception.
Yeah.
And it is a little bit of a leap for him to then just go and check for paint marks on the back of on the bus. I think the distinction that needs to be made is that he's getting an overall idea from touching the bag.
Yeah.
And he's actually still a police detective, essentially. That's his experience. And he goes back to he tries to solve the main problem, the overarching problem, by doing the actual small investigative stuff. It's when he walks away from the school bus is when you start to get that spooky Frank Black vibe, where he's like, well, dude, crime scene's over here, man.
Yeah, it's 5 miles down the road.
Yeah, yeah. How do you know? Experience. Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So where do you lie with Frank's gift then? I can't remember if you mentioned that in your previous episode last season, but where do you fall with the season one version compared to season two, and where it ends up here, where we do have things like the single blade of grass, which is clearly the changing point for his vision? Where do you stand with that?
I like to think that season two moved with it relatively tastefully. to some degree. I think their idea of an end goal is what they had, And in some episodes, like, it's really well done. It's quite subtle, and the blend between season one and season two doesn't feel too jarring. And then in other episodes, you're just like, oh, God, sorry, what? How did he? So he is psychic. Is he not psychic? And you know, there's even characters that will come along and sort of question it, and it's almost kind of like a joke. And Peter Watts does a funny little head wobble, and it's like, oh no, he's not psychic, but. Is he? you're not. I don't think it ever really face to face pulls the trigger on the subject. Even at the end of maybe season three, it doesn't really ever physically just stop and say, "Look, this is how it is."
There's comments that I can't remember which episode it was in, but where Peter would say, "You know, you have a gift, Frank."
Yeah,
but the gift is, you know, you could take that either way, couldn't you? You could take it as you've just got a gift of being able to solve these crimes, or you've got a physical, you know, and totally psychic gift. So yeah, it does leave ambivalent, which I do quite like. I like something that's more ambiguous than not ambivalent.
Yes.
Christianity features quite heavily in the show overall, and you look to the fourth horseman at the end of the season. You go back to the pilot, and there's a strong Christianity feel to it.
Uh-huh.
The Native American aspects, which we talked about before with Single Blade of Grass, comes up occasionally. And also Siren, we get the Chinese and Asian kind of aspect to that as well, that there's all of these things going on around the world. And this is something that's linking in with to a point with this episode, because there is so many things happening around the world, and it's all building up to what would be the apocalypse. And I think that's probably their overarching thought, that we're seeing this through a lens of Christianity, but each individual culture may have their own version, but something is happening, and something is getting to the crux of the millennium and the turn of that. So when we do see that there is the children praying in the back of the van while and then the abductors do actually start to pray, what did you take away from that? And did you think it was an effective scene?
That is probably my favourite scene from the episode, barring the tornado appearance at the end.
I
think that, yeah, there's something quite touching about the way, you know, the kids and the bus driver sort of, yeah, they all join hands. They're pretty on it. I mean, they acknowledge early doors it's Bible Belt country. So it's kind of, it's not out of nowhere that they've set this up quite nicely. And then, so you flow into that, and it's like, oh yeah, and their prayer time. And I think the transition to the front of the truck with the two guys holding hands, and they join a prayer in sequence. So you've got the kids' voices underneath, you've got their voices over the top, and you've got the weird sort of dead inside delivery of the driver. and yeah, the whole thing's got a spookiness to it, but I think it sort of serves... I don't know, would you say on your first viewing that you expected the twist as such as it is?
I don't think I would have. I think that I generally, on first watches on anything, just kind of, I don't look too deeply into it unless it's obvious procedural TV. I mean, I've just watched an episode of Blacklist before. And spoiler alert for anyone's watching Blacklist, but you know, pretty much within the first 10 minutes, I went, "It's the podcaster," you know. So you're about half an hour ahead of everyone else because you know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But with this, I would have just gone along with the ride, and I wouldn't have really appreciated what was happening. And I think that even at the end of the episode, I probably would have had to have rewatched it to fully understand. And yeah. I probably still don't understand it to this day. I mean, when you're talking about things like the Book of Revelation, the seven seals and the seven symbolic seals of whatever, and, you know, he is the lamb and things, you know, that's beyond my capabilities of understanding.
Yeah, fair.
So, I would have gone along with the ride, and I definitely wouldn't have expected it to be that way. You'd have thought it's just a normal, you know, abduction storyline, maybe find out more about why he's doing it, but not the twist, I don't think.
So would you say that the prayer in the shared prayer that they all have in the drive, does that make him scarier, or what does it do for you in terms of him as this episode's boogeyman, as he currently is at this point in the episode?
It throws your thought process into a more of a, oh, right, I'm not quite sure what's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the juxtaposition of, you know, they're having the prayer, and then you're moving into the front of the van, and they're also having the prayer, and you're thinking, well, which side am I meant to be on here?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's that. What is? Why is he doing it? Why are they? Why are they praying with along with them? Why are they still? You know, and as you say, having the Bible belt kind of aspect to it, that it's heavily religious thing. It puts into your mind. Is what are his motives for doing this? And then it kind of throws you off, because you're thinking it's not just a typical abduction. There is something deeper into it. And yeah, I do appreciate that. I think it's a really good way of doing it. Which comes to my next question. Something that Darren Mooney's mentioned over the last few episodes that he's been on, that Millennium tends to try to talk about the why something has happened. And this is the perfect time to talk about that scene that we're talking about, the Bible aspect of it.
Yeah.
Where Sheriff Casey doesn't want to understand the why, but he just wants to know how. And Millennium does tend to try and work out the reasons for something happening, rather than just being, you know, a lot of times not logical leaps that are in there, because there's more about the reason why that person is doing what they're doing. This obviously has a big aspect to that, with the whole mind map thing that he's got going on.
Mm-hmm.
Did you think that was a strong, powerful message that was coming across, that it was more about the episode as a whole I'm talking about here, really, that it was more about the story, the grander scheme of things, and the why he was doing it, rather than just, you know, he was an evil person that wanted to do such and such to whoever. Did you appreciate that?
I did appreciate that. People ask why a lot, but I also very, very much appreciate the answer is never actually given, as far as I'm aware. You know, there's a lot of build-up and stuff. There's all these people trying to... I mean, Laura Means does come in and tries to decode him, and they're looking at his, you know, his mind maps, and they're talking about stuff, but he's ultimately treated like he's Loco Grande still. Like, obviously it's very real to him, but everyone else is kind of passing up on it a little bit. And even, I don't know whether it's you know, Lance Henriksen not being too comfortable with his material, but he's, when they're in the cell together going through the mind map, he's almost talking to him like a child.
Yeah.
Which, if that had been redone slightly, I think we could have got a better angle on it. But obviously he gets taken, spoiler alert, he gets taken away by a tornado, ultimately. And with him, the answers also completely disappear.
Yeah.
And I really like how that is done, that we spend half an hour asking, why is this happening? What's his motivation? And ultimately it was, the religious stuff kind of went over my head a little bit. But his goal was to pretty much save the children so they could go on to do something else. Is that correct? Yeah.
So the way that I foresee it is that there is a school. The school was going to get hit, that all of the signs, which is something I'll come back to in a second about numbers, that some of the signs were that these people had to be protected. All of them had to be protected, because in one of them, there'll be a special one that's going to protect them in the coming apocalypse, World War III, call it what you will. Which if you relate it to modern times, would be like one of those girls were going to grow up and become Greta Thunberg, basically.
I believe the sheriff's daughter, a few years on from this, does actually feature quite prominently in an episode of Stargate, and she does hold the entire world in her hands at one point.
Well, there you go. That's the link I would never have got in a million years.
Same universe, same universe.
Millennium and Stargate. Fantastic. Oh, I like that. No, I'll definitely have to check that out.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is the elements of something. We both said that we're not, going to connect the religious aspects to a degree. We get a basic understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens in the likes of The Curse of Frank Brack and and a few other episodes is the link with numbers. And I know this is something that comes in to a lot of TV shows, things like Lost and Manifest are two that come up instantly in my head where they use repeating numbers and mm-hmm. Little tidbits here. But they're using this for 1919, that there was 18 victims, not 19, and that's how we connect to finding Prine. What do you think that's a good thing to do, to link these numbers with, you know, it's a bit contrived, I get that, but that there's this ulterior power that's actually causing these things to happen, that they are linking numbers together. And what did you think to his capture? And yeah, you've already mentioned about the it's a bit cold, but Lara's kind of revelation being brought in because of her knowledge, her ability to actually tell what he's going to be doing or put that into effect.
The numbers are they're sort of brought in and then they're pretty easily discarded.
Yeah,
the 1919 aspect. I think he's quoting from it later on as it goes, and then at the end of the episode, he's kind of shouting that verse into the wind, I think. Mm. But the actual physical connection made with numbers seems, apologies for dropping the C-bomb, it is a bit contrived. And it's kind of just a vehicle to get the episode going and just for a way for them to find him, essentially. Although it does give me the satisfaction with Frank Black coming off the hot tag and absolutely tackling that guy down some stairs. Yeah. I just worry about Lance Henriksen. I'm like, dude, you got to be like 60 there. Stop. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, he's often in the first season, doesn't get involved, or if he does, he walks into a room quietly and sits down and talks to people. But this is probably, apart from the brutal murder of the spoiler stalker,
yeah,
I think this is probably his most... I mean, I know there's another fight scene in season 3 where he's involved, which is a really good fight scene. I think it's 7-1, I think it is. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Yeah.
But, he gets a bit of do, does our Frank in this one. So, speaking of action, speaking of plot moving forward, what did you take... What were your takes on the... Weather hunters, and it's red herringness, and also we can also talk a little bit about the music and the change in pace during that scene. What did you think to those things with regards to that element, especially being a massive red herring?
I quite like the red herring factor for it. It's I think once you get maybe 30 seconds into the chase, you're like, all right, episode, this is a red herring, but you've got me because this is quite a nice tense sequence. You kind of know what the payoff is. I'm a big fan of technobabble info dumps, like when there's two guys on the floor and they just basically tell you everything that you ever need to know about storm chasing to the point where the sheriff's like, guys, what are you talking about? And then everyone kind of points out what's going on. But the music here is absolutely brilliant. It's definitely the sound of Mark Snow doing 24 episodes of The X-Files and 24 episodes of Millennium per year, in the sense that there's probably about half an hour of just stuff coming through your speakers. But there's moments like this. There's moments where... like the prayer in the truck. There's moments where you just kind of got people looking forlorn off into the distance. You've got this really nice music that comes in. There's like a Roland synth flute or something, which, people say that, synthesizer flutes are tacky, but I think they're delicious. And this chase scene kind of has, it's really hard to describe. It's like an up-tempo sort of synth thing, but it's never aggressive like you would find in a contemporary score. It doesn't feel the need to just have like 20 Japanese dudes hitting drums or something like that. It's really quite a reserved piece, but it just quickens the pace. It double times everything almost. And you've got pretty decent actors doing the police here that bring some intensity to it. You've got a real nice edit. You've got some geography establishment, which I absolutely love. and just shouting orders down the radio. It's all really nice, tight stuff for maybe a 45-second, minute-long sequence almost.
I would echo those. With it has some elements of, it doesn't quite go to the NICE and 731 kind of feel to it, because that's a lot more, for the nature of the fact that it's on a train, has more of a percussion-y kind of drill to it. Mm-hmm. Whereas this falls back on there, but you still hear elements that he's used. It's, as you say, he's done so many episodes of The X-Files, he's done so many episodes of Millennium, he's kind of melded the two together.
Yeah.
And it's come with a slower paced, but ramping up the bit of tension, which I quite like, and I thought it was a particularly good scene. I mean, you mentioned about the fact that, you know, pretty new, it was pretty much a red herring, and I think it's the moment when Peter basically says, well, from out of state, that doesn't sound right. You're like, there you go then. That's the end of that then.
Yeah, they're reeling off all the stuff on the over the police comms, like they're all feeding back information. And at any point, Frank Black's just gonna shake his head and go, "Nah, it's not them. They've bin it off." But it's kind of, he knows he needs to do it to basically give the sheriff something to kind of give him a little way to break off steam. Maybe they sort of have to go through it. I think Frank takes quite a significant backseat in this episode. And there are points where he kind of says stuff where he relates to the sheriff, and you kind of get the impression that he's letting him take the charge, but he is going to pull him back every now and again.
Yeah.
It's an interesting time post-killing Toombs, Polaroid Man, sorry. where he's kind of he's sort of hot and cold on the sticking one foot forward kind of thing. And to further kind of echo on about the music, in case we miss it later, Mark Snow's, this is a standalone score, I would say, in that these flutes don't, the specific sounds don't come back again in this season, I don't think.
Right.
But as always, you know, in the last 5 minutes of the episode, he manages to make whatever is unique about that episode blend back into the overall Millennium theme. And you get people stood around at the end kind of looking at each other, and the whole thing's resolving, and your episode theme will slowly just blend into that E minor on the violin. You're like, yeah, Mark, god damn it, every time, dude. You are a worker. You're a working man.
We then see, within the actual scene, it's in the prison where we have him locked up, and Lara checks, makes the error on the floor. There's a scene, I think it's just before that, where Sheriff Casey comes in and they find blood on the clothes, and he says, "We've got you now." And Frank then says, "You know, we've lost round one," and they then end up in a field looking for all these bloodstained clothes. What did you think of that misdirection, and did you see that coming? And what are your thoughts on that, and the aspects that they use things like, it was lamb's blood, it was painted on, but it was a nice little detour for Frank to go down, another red herring in the episode.
Again, it's kind of piling on more mystery to this guy, in that he's sort of jumping through the hoops of serial killer 101 kind of thing, almost to a naive extent, where he's just got like kids' clothes and just rubbed it in some blood. They're like, yeah, that'll do. And then throws it out the car window kind of thing. And there's sort of one step ahead of him. The sheriff bites, obviously, because he's really annoyed. He thinks his little girl's dead. But Frank and Lara, obviously, they're a little bit more wiser to it. I think it's nice. I say nice. What am I talking about? I think it's an effective sort of another, ooh, is it? What is this guy? Did he kill the kids? But no, we cut away to the kids in a shipping container. What is the overall goal here? And then you're asking why? Why is he doing this? Why is he misdirected? Is he trying to self-punish, get himself locked up? I don't understand what's going on. But obviously we figure out why he's done it later on. But it's really nice misdirection for characters, certain characters, and misdirection for audience as well. I think it's really good.
And now, obviously, there is things to deeper look into with regards to the as I say, it was the lamb, and what does he consider himself as, the horseman or the lamb, and things like that, which is which is really good because, you know, moving into the end of the season two, where you do get the Fourth Horseman, which carries on that theme as we go through. I mean, we're in episode seven now.
Yeah.
So we're a third of the way through the season. We've had the Curse of Frank Black. We're getting episodes where things are starting to take form and Lara's kind of introduced again here. And, you know, we've had Monster with her in, and all these little things are starting just to build up, just to give us an idea as we get into the mid-season and then obviously the run to the end. And that's something that's really good for Millennium, is even though that the, you know, likes of Sheriff Casey, where Frank says, you know, I've been there, doesn't overtly say anything about the beginning and the end, but there is that through line that we are moving forward. There is a propulsiveness about it that we are getting going somewhere,
so which leads me to I'm interject very briefly.
Yeah.
So you asked whether you thought he was the lamb or the horseman. Do you think by the end of the episode, the implication, what with the blood being on the clothes, is that one of the kids is the lamb?
Yeah.
The lamb is Jesus, right? The lamb's
the lamb's going to be Jesus, isn't it? So unless he is the lamb because he sacrificed himself for them, so you could see it that way, I think. Yeah, it's certainly worth debating, and I think, I would perceive him as being like the Jesus type figure, that he's sacrificed himself for the greater good, and that he has done that to not be judged in time, and his time has come. He's served his purpose, and then obviously the next one it would be the next coming would be the girl. So that's the way I would see it. Would you say that, or would you say it another way?
So. That does, if he does see himself as Jesus, as the Lamb, that does present an interesting point that normally, I mean, this may be what they were going for. They would have presented that character with like maybe a severe ego or God complex. And it's potentially, you could read that into this guy early doors in this episode. Mm. But by the end of it, he does quite happily sacrifice himself. He does put himself in harm's way. He does a lot of things to basically divert the police at the cost of his own well-being.
Yeah.
Which you wouldn't normally see in something like this. It would be kind of rooted that he had an ego problem and he would be kind of frauded at the end. He would be outed kind of thing. But in this, he actually does get potentially 50-50 on that, whether he just dies or not. whether he does actually get the resolution that was in his head the whole time. So I found that really interesting, if he is intended to be the lamb. I think that's a really sort of interesting way for a 90s TV show to do something.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because as you say, because obviously Jesus is considered to some that, you know, he was this basic weirdos, like sort of saying all these things and doing all these things, and you know, and when you think of Jesus like figures, you think, oh, they're a bit crazy. But the fact that he has that element to him, but it's kind of subverting what you would expect, because he's not all out there praising the Lord or anything like that. He's more grounded, and he comes across as someone who's really concerned. And you know, especially when I think that one of the telling lines is when he realizes that there isn't the 18th child there, and it's like, I told you, it won't work without that extra child. You need to find him. I think that you know, there's a fear in him at that point. You know, it's not going to work. This is not going to work, and he has the conviction of his beliefs. But it's not to, he's not preaching. You know, even when he's in the jail cells, and when he's talking to the sheriff, he's kind of like, you know, he's done all these like diversionary tactics. Likes of the field with all the kids' clothing and things, because he's trying to protect them. But he's not saying anything about that. He just wants it to go the way he wants it to go, which I really appreciate.
Yeah. Would you say, and how do you feel about this guy's acting? Would you say, how do you feel that he brings this character across? Because I find him quite fascinating.
Yeah. He's not one that automatically jumps out at me on the page when I think about season two and the episodes, characters that we've got in the show. But is that because he's underplaying it so quite effectively that, you know, we're not getting it's not wooden either. I think there's, mm-hmm. there's a real fine line between the two, where I think if you'd given it to another actor, I think it would have come across as different. I think the way it's underplayed is actually quite effective, personally, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What say you?
I picked it up maybe on my second watch through. I was just kind of amazed that the guy never really looks anyone in the eyes.
Mm.
And that was something I noticed early on. Once he comes out of his trailer at the start and he gets the vision, like, he almost has a permanent frown.
Yeah.
And he sort of just glazes over and he's constantly staring into some middle ground distance. And he manages to do a lot of interesting deliveries, you know, various intensities, but his expression ultimately doesn't change that much. Not in a he's a terrible actor kind of way.
Yeah.
But in a he's almost in I suppose it's kind of like a method acting thing, maybe.
Yeah.
But there's a zone that he's sort of in, and he looks like early on he looks like a psychopath. And then later on it kind of you just think, oh no, it's kind of focused. It's kind of a heavy sorrow there sort of thing. It's more of a melancholy that's across his whole... Yeah, yeah. It's great, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I think the scenes, you know, the smile, for example, could have come across as comic, and it mm-hmm. doesn't when they say that we've lost round one. He does this little, tiny little wry smile,
mm-hmm.
and that comes across really well. So, yeah, I think underplayed is probably the best way of putting it. And,
yeah.
you know, he doesn't stand out, but then... The story in some ways the story, even though he's like the guest star, he's not the emphasis of the show. The emphasis of the show is actually the daughter, Jessica Casey. That's who mm-hmm. the episode is about, really, isn't it? It's not about yep. Frank. Frank's taking his back seat. You've got Sheriff Casey. It's more of a central role for him and for Jessica. Even like sort of, there's a line I think where they say about. Can't remember exactly what was said, but it said that her dad says this to her, and it's kind of a really nice little turnaround account on it. I might be in my notes somewhere, you know, whereas in, like, for example, Lamentation, I mentioned in Lamentation when Gable House has this weird pan up to him, this horror kind of pan up to him, and he looks at it. It looks awful, you know. But you don't really get any of that in this, and I think it's well done.
Yeah.
We have the Millennium Group is my next little note that I've got here.
Ooh.
So Peter asks, well, basically says that they've got a database for these type of things. He also says that he can get rid of the parking tickets that Frank's mysteriously got with people which I thought was interesting in itself, where it's a car he doesn't own and he doesn't quite know why he's getting these parking tickets. And then Peter obviously says about the fact that, you know, the certain books are logged by the Millennium Group for exactly this reason. One, what did you think of the Millennium Group in season two, now that I've got you into season two, compared to season one? And then secondly, what did you think of season two's arc up until this point? And we're getting this mysterious aspect to the group where they can all of a sudden they're tracking things, they've got, seems to have sites all around the country, that they've got these elements that, you know, they're checking out when people buy Bibles or when they buy the Book of Revelation or when they get certain books on Apocrypha and things like that. What did you take out of that episode and then the Millennium Group itself?
Very important question. Does the thing with the parking tickets ever come back again?
Not that I think so, no. I think it's kind of a throwaway. But that really is interesting because there's a couple of things. In Paper Dove, there's a yep. phone call that Catherine gets, which never gets answered, which never gets picked up again. And then we've got, there's a couple of hang-ups that Frank gets in the beginning and the end, which never really get answered either. And where he's, you know, he's having to have the caller ID, which is fantastic 90s television, where you get the caller ID where he's got they try and change it over because he's got like a counter to it, and et cetera, et cetera,
right.
et cetera. And then you get these parking tickets as well. But as far as I'm aware, I don't think it ever comes up again. So no is your answer to that question.
Like, if this was Babylon 5, you know that those parking tickets would have a standalone film made in 2003. You know that, that would come around. They would never let that thread go.
Yeah.
Okay, that was... Yeah, I just... Because it's been so long since I've watched all of it to kind of get the mythos back in my head. I didn't know whether they would ever come back in and it was part of a larger thing.
As I say, I don't think so. I mean, I think the... I'm not sure if it was the caller ID thing was later on in... I think it was in Sense and Anti-Sense, actually. I think he may have got some calls. But it doesn't seem... just seems to be there for just for the sake of it. And I think I even mentioned in Sense and Anti-Sense, if anyone wants to correct me or correct us, then, you know, we're more than happy for people to do that because it's not jumping out at me. And we're 7 episodes into the season now and I still can't remember if it ever comes back.
In terms of your original question, I like the ambiguity of the group in the first season. There is a very, very subtle hint of something more, and I think it is quite subtle. And they are played, you know, they introduce themselves as retired police officers, essentially.
Yeah.
I think that's quite a nice angle. It explains the older dude, the fact that Frank is an older male lead, which is quite unusual for the time. And I think, is the fella in episode 3, season 1, that gets microwaved, is he a member of the Millennium Group or just Frank's friend?
The guy in the microwave is Mike Atkins. He was in...
That's the one.
He was in season 1 twice. He was in... Powers, Principalities, Thrones and Dominions, and he was in Gehenna. Those are the two. And we've got a running joke with Mike Atkins because he always seems to put himself into danger, like walking into a giant microwave, you know, without any backup, which is fantastic. But yeah, he's in season 1, Mike. So you've got that, and that has been raised actually before as well when I've talked about Millennium Group season 2. Is that, was Mike in on it? Did he have any? Any kind of story other than that he was just a part of the Academy group and he was retired, that's called thrown out the window. So you've got to put your headcanon on to integrate Mike into that story because, as I say, he's in 2 episodes and he's an upstanding character and you wouldn't expect him to be in what would become season 2 of Millennium.
Yes. Is he introduced as being part of the Millennium group?
I'm not 100% sure, but he does seem to be part of them, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I suppose when I think about the Millennium Group in season 3, it's kind of, it's more Illuminati-like, and it feels like, rather than us understanding them more and finding out more about them and our perception changing because of that, it feels like the character of the group as a whole and the people in it are being rewritten as we go along.
Yeah.
To basically, out of necessity, basically, whether that be from test audiences' feedback, whether that's from Chris Carter trying to figure out what happened when he was away. Like, God, what the hell were you... Who is this? Why? Psychic? No. No, he's not psychic. He's an alien. Oh, sorry, Chris. I think season 2, I can just about get on board with it. By season 3, I'm kind of like, okay, Millennium Group, you do your thing. This is... In this episode, the way they're referenced, I like it. The way that Frank sort of asks those questions to Peter, and Peter, I would say, does give him an honest answer, but he only gives him what he's willing to say.
Yeah.
And the exchange between those two, it's only a small one, but it is very nice, and I think it offers something larger outside of the episode. If I was to take anything in terms of carryover, in terms of a story arc, it would be that exchange. You've mentioned Jessica Casey a few times. Does she come back into it later on?
No, she doesn't.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Okay. So I would say that conversation is the take-home sort of story arc almost.
Yeah. and also as well, I've actually just found it's not what you've done, it's what you're going to do. And that's what Jessica's dad says to her.
Yes.
And it's referred to that. That's what it says. It's not what you've done, it's what you're going to do. So I think that Darren Mooney has said over his episodes that the Millennium is all about thinking, where aliens, whereas the X-Files is all about the apologies and the looking back at the atrocities that we've done. Millennium's mm-hmm. more about looking to the future. And yeah. this is an epitome of that, that I'm going to say it again, Greta Thunberg kind of character. You know, yeah. She's going to end up doing, you know, become something. And, you know, the whole episode revolves around her that, she's being protected because she's going to do something great in the future. And that's kind of the takeaway for that. The whole thing about this World War III and this apocalypse and the apocalypse that's coming towards the end of season two as well. That we get. And this premise of things have happened in the past. Did you think that whole theme for the episode really works? That it's not about now, it's about what's happened and what's going to happen. Did you think that was a good theme for them to use in this episode in particular?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I mean, we're spoilt these days with just like 8-season story arcs of stuff. And with this, I kind of expect that theme to keep dropping back in and dropping back in and thinking of the future. It doesn't really realise itself to a degree I can pick up consistently. It's kind of a message that comes and then it sort of goes. And, you know, if this was me, I'd be thinking, you know, for 6 months, I'd be sat in my basement with Catherine shouting me for tea. Like, hang on a minute, this guy literally got sucked up by a tornado that he knew was coming because he thought he was Jesus.
Yeah.
Hold the phone. What? Hang on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's one of the things I really like about this episode is this foreshadowing. And I think the foreshadowing outside of the episode, if we were to get real meta, sorry for the wanky phrasing.
No, I love a bit of meta. I'm a Darren Mooney. I'm a Darren Morgan fan, so anything meta is good for me.
Right, cool. I think this episode feels, I probably couldn't word it particularly gracefully, but it feels quite prophetic of the actual times ahead to come. You could probably put this on in 2003 and say it was a post 9/11 kind of, if Millennium had carried on going, this wouldn't feel out of place in 2002, 2003. This feels bizarrely prophetic outside of the actual walls of the story itself. It's very interesting.
This is what Millennium is all about, really, isn't it? It's about the concerns of what people are feeling. And you know, it mentions things like I would say that, no doubt there'll be things like Iraq is mentioned in the episode, that there will be, you know, there'll be some sort of element of, you know, the wars over in the Middle East and Afghanistan and all that aspect to it, that there's, you know, various different things. If we took a good 2 or 3 hours to go through every single piece of thing written on that floor, that, you know, it was a time of quite a lot of upheaval and, you know, and people say a bit of innocence before 2001, but again, you're saying if there was a bit of innocence, there wasn't, because all these things were building up to that, you know, to stage of when 2001 happened, that, you know, the world changed on that day. Yes, it did. But there were all these shows like Millennium that were pointing out that there was, you know, these fears and these real life, you know, late 90s struggles and people were getting to that point. And I definitely think that that is a sign of the times. I mean, we've only got to look at The Lone Gunman. If you did watch The Lone Gunman, I don't know if you did see that season, did you?
The computer guys, is that their spin-off thing?
I
never got to see it. I probably should.
Well, the first episode, if we're talking about prophetic, the first episode was a Boeing 747 being remote controlled and was potentially going to be flown into the Twin Towers.
And goodness,
that was in May in 2001. That got released. So there was all these elements of things that you know were building up, and I think that Millennium and the 10-13 productions were particularly sensitive to that. You know, I think that a lot of people do diss Chris Carter and the show, or the X-Files and Millennium and various other aspects that he's done, but I think that he does have these. I mean, even like the new X-File seasons there, where he's thinking years ahead of other people and he's seeing these things.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's a very astute guy, is Chris Carter. So, yeah, definitely a thumbs up from me on that, because, as you say, it's very meta. He's very he's got his finger on the pulse about things that are going to happen, not necessarily about, you know, what has happened, which is really interesting, and no doubt there'll be a thesis somewhere about it.
I'm sure there will be. Yeah, I'll be interested to find it, actually.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What did you? We're coming to the end of the episode now, so I think this has been a fantastic discussion about the episode, and it's really opened my eyes and made me think about other things as well, especially with the likes of the lamb and the horses and things like that. But what did you make of the final elements? We've got Lara saying that he's got this tick and that could be used, and then we do the whole seven thing, which I'll keep referring back to. And then the final scenes where we get the unnamed, excellent supporting cast man with the gun, and then the tornado and the reveal at the end. What did you think of to that whole last scene?
I think the tick thing, again, we've got 45 minutes, so like we just got to do this, bro. But the tick thing does feel like Poundland psychology. But then I absolutely love the way she says, in about 30 seconds, we'll find out whether we should have just beat it out of him or not. And everyone just kind of gives her this look like, whoa, sorry, what? What can I say? I'm results orientated.
Yeah.
I
did like that little line. I thought that was really good. And then what did you think thinking about that, Millennium in season two tries to be a bit more lighthearted? Did you like that development that, you know, and one of the things that Millennium season one was said that it was really dark and really grim, but season two tried to change that a little bit. Did you particularly like that aspect of it?
To a degree, I think the gold of where it works is between your core cast chemistry. I think having Laura Means in there, and I think having more Peter Watts and a more conversational Peter Watts, not just a guy that lurks outside your house with a folder, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That sort of lightens it a bit for me. What doesn't work is what feels like the comedy episodes that were a bit too wacky or a little bit too offbeat to be X-Files episodes.
Right.
And sort of make their way through here, and they make their way through into season three as well. There's just some moments of sheer goofiness where it's almost like Lance Henriksen's like, oh man, really? I was in Hard Target. I was a badass in that film.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, I don't mind some of the wacky, the Jose Chung and Somehow Satan Got Behind Me, but the Kiss episode is worst episode of TV of all time. Hate it.
The Kiss episode, yes, that is the kind of stuff I'm referring to. Yeah. Jose Chung and Somehow Satan Got Behind Me, they go all in. They go absolutely all in, no problem. I'm a big fan of that because everyone's just sort of, you know, hitting it home with the performances. The writing's pretty snappy and top notch. It's stuff like the Kiss episode. Oh my God. Well, oh.
Basically, we get to the, as we were saying about the end scene, that we've got the tornado that takes them away. We've mentioned that a few times, and the reveal that was quite nicely directed, actually, and quite nicely, and some of the imagery we see Lara, where the sunlight lands on her face, similar to the way that it landed on her face in the episode where she's introduced as well in Monster, where she sees the angel, the lighting on that. So yeah. I like that kind of aspect to it. And there's also the reveal that the kids have actually, you know, there's a moment where we think the kids have been lost forever, and then we find out that they've been unearthed and they're all fine. What did you make of that final scene, including the last bit, where it's Frank basically rhyming off, it will be the children that saves us, and that comes to the end of the episode. So what did you think to that those last few minutes?
I think the shootout around the car is awesome, really intense stuff. Then when the weather starts coming, you know, it starts picking up, you see the tornado. I think, again, it's a great performance by guest star. The way his expression for the first time in half an hour actually finally changes, when he's in the back of the car just quoting prophecy, and Casey's threatening to blow his head off, basically. He's still got that expression, but once he gets out of the car, he sees the tornado. There's a wonderful change in his whole demeanour And he's chained up as well, and he kind of raises his arms towards it, and it's got a really, there's really beautiful imagery here. Like, you could put a dove in that guy's hands outstretched, and that would be a Renaissance painting, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In terms of the kids coming out of the ground, you could possibly be a little bit more on the nose about Jesus coming out of that cave with the resurrection, but, you know, you couldn't go more on the nose by far.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really nicely done, though. I think only on maybe the second viewing I got the symbolism there.
Yeah.
But it's somehow the episode manages to maintain neutrality, almost. Like, it's using all this imagery and bordering on touched by an angel territory at this point.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you've got 3 stone cold cops just watching the whole thing happen, and they just, yeah, there's a neutrality that I really like about this.
Yeah,
and the events are viewed as events rather than, like, you know, Peter Watts doesn't just, like, tip his head into the frame and go, "That's in the Bible." Yeah, okay, thank you.
The reason why I also mentioned about Lara as well, the episode of Monster where she sees what she sees in her gift.
Yeah.
That this is kind of, you have that same feeling. And in Monster, she says that it warns her of great evil coming.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we've got this juxtaposition in some ways, but also that they've been released from the ground for, or the one, you know, which is obviously the Jessica, has been released because she's going to be doing that kind of work. And I think that's a nice little link, even if it would have been meant. I would expect that there's that link between both Monster and what Lara's seeing. The only thing that's missing is obviously the what you would see in Lara's point of view, that she might even see that figure in the episode, but we don't see that. We just see the sunshine bearing down on her. You can take that both ways. And as I say, you've just mentioned there with the way that the kids start to appear as well, that there's definitely symbolism in that whole scene.
Yeah. And what was that end line from Frank? We should probably talk about that.
Basically, at the very end, they're walking outside of what looks like the school, strangely enough. And they say that the schoolhouse was completely destroyed. So had they gone to school, they would have all died. And they then start sort of, and then I think the turnaround is like, was he there for a reason? What was he? Who was he? Why was he? Kind of question mark. And then Frank says, they start talking about the children. There's an image on the file of the children. And then Frank says, it will be the children that saves us. And then that's when we fade to black. And then that's the end of the episode. So that's kind of the link that we get, is that the story is that it's going to be the future generations that will turn the course of future. So what did you make of that final, as you say, it's touched by an angel territory, really, isn't it?
When you walk in a I don't really get the line in the context of the episode. Like I say, I ran through the episode quite a few times the day at work, just on loop, and I just didn't get it. It just felt like a line that was banged in just to sort of wrap everything up, but I don't really... I mean, it does wrap stuff up, but not in the context of what just happened, if that makes sense.
It's almost like a coda to just to say this is what the theme was about, but without really giving any depth to it. I don't know. I don't know. It's unusual. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how they would have changed. I don't know how they would have changed it, because I think even, you know, if I think to the X-File days, and I can't remember what the episode, De Handy Valettes, where the way that ends, and that's a Morgan and One episode as well.
Yeah.
That they finish that with, it's been nice working with you, on the blackboard with the Susan Blomart character. And the information is that she's the devil and that they've been working with him. And I think it would have been interesting to leave it at where the schoolhouse was completely destroyed and then left it at that and a pan out from there. And then you would be left to think about what you're talking about. But then for some reason, they've put this extra line in, which I'm not quite sure why.
Yeah, it just doesn't need to be there. I mean, don't get me wrong, I will listen to Lance Henriksen just read like a gluten-free menu to me all day long. Like, he could read chemistry books to me and I would be fascinated.
Yeah.
Yeah. But don't get him to just say random stuff. It feels like maybe something was missing, or they just bolted it on at the end because they happened to be... this would be nice. Let's just add this in, sort of thing.
Mm.
You feel like Peter Watt should say something, Lara Mean should say something. It's almost like what happens after the camera's cut.
Yeah.
Does Peter Watts just kind of look at him and go, nice one, yeah. I'm going to go. I'll see you next week. It's just this prophetic moment that doesn't really do anything.
Thinking about it over the last sort of couple of minutes there, I think it would have been probably better to leave it as it was ambiguous anyway, with the, you know, the school would have been destroyed. I think leaving it there would have been interesting, and to use a musical term, it would be an imperfect cadence, wouldn't it? It's just literally, so you're not quite getting, not getting the full final, this is the end, where this is trying to do a cadence, a perfect cadence, and finish it off, and it doesn't really work for me.
I would have happily settled for a pan out with Mark Snow doing that stuff on the synth flutes, and then it turns into the violin, and it's the Millennium theme, executive producer Chris Carter, blah, 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 let's move on.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have worked for me. Just ambiguity with a bit of music. Let's have a nice pan out. Yeah, as you say.
Well, I think that leaves us to finish the episode. So I know that you're not on social media too much, but since you last spoke to Russ, what have you been up to, and what projects are you currently on with?
Oh, since that episode with Russ, I've had quite an eventful life, to be honest. I'm still working on my Dungeons and Dragons tabletop audio project, which is headed to Kickstarter potentially the end of this year, start of next year.
Fantastic.
Which is, that's going to be great. We're looking for a lofty 50,000. 25 grand, and then 50,000 in stretch goals, mostly because to produce all the material that I need in the promises, it's going to take me about 2 years sat in this chair doing it. So
it needs
to keep me fed. It needs to pay for session musicians. It needs to do quite a lot and go quite a long way.
I think you were doing a project with about a horror film, or it was kind of loosely based on Brexit, or the theme of Brexit on, I think. And that was probably over a year ago, and we're still talking about Brexit at this moment in time. We are before Halloween at the moment during this recording, so.
Yeah, yeah. All them lovely adverts on TV telling me to buy loads of beans. Like, oh my God, stop it. That film, it had its premiere, crew and cast screening at a local cinema. It went down an absolute storm. I was working on that in through the nights, and also doing cover shifts at my shop job during the day. And my goodness, I didn't know I had it in me. At 32, I did not think I could live off 2 hours a night for a week and still be productive. Like, my sales figures were up. I managed to produce the audio for half a film. Like, what is going on? I should do that more often. The sleep thing is overrated. But the film, it's come up really well, and I think it's going to do all right on the national festival circuit. I think it's definitely a British thing, and hopefully it can go stateside and get some traction as a quirky British horror comedy.
Cool. And what's the film called?
Chestersburg.
Chestersburg. I'll look out for it. We're almost at Halloween, so if there's a copy lying around anywhere, I'll be watching that.
I can see a man about getting you a link to a Vimeo if that's your kind of thing.
Well, it'd certainly be interesting to see it. Absolutely, it'd be nice to see what kind of work you're into. So,
What have you been up to? We've just met.
we have. My world is revolving around my work. Pretty much at the moment, I've got a lot going on. We've got a big culture and arts centre, but it's also a conference centre as well. So there's a lot going on there. I do spend quite a bit of time in a projection room with a 60-foot cinema screen. So I enjoy that a lot. So I get to see a lot of the new releases and some Indian art dependent films, things like Fleabag from the National Theatre, which has just been out recently.
Yeah.
So I get to see some stuff like that, which is fantastic. Just preparing for Star Wars 9 now. Getting ready for that to come out, and we've got some plans to spoiler alert, a Darth Vader came around about 3 years ago, and it was a 6'3" bloke who had the same sort of frame as myself, which was fantastic. For 3 weeks of spending my time as Darth Vader was quite an interesting take for 3 years. But on top of that, mainly just this podcast, really. I've got my other podcast, Pick Up a Podcast, which I'm trying to get back on the road, but I think it might be late this year, early next year before I do that. And that's a podcast on podcasters. So I interview.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, so I interview people who have got a podcast, and they give me their backstory and how they got into it and how they do things. So, and I've had your colleague on during that time as well. Yeah, I had Rob on my show. So yeah, so it's that's good. So I'll be probably hopefully pulling that back out the bag. And then just concentrating on the time is now, really, just producing this along with Tony, and I'm getting to the end of my little run at the moment with this episode, so I will be back later in the season. I think I've got an episode with Tony, but Tony's taken over for things I think are slightly out of order. Here's a spoiler for those people outside: we don't record episodes in chronological order.
shock
horror. So he's doing things like getting ready for The Curse of Frank Black, which will be out on Halloween, things like that. So he's dealing with that. And other than that, just generally messing around on Twitter at rmuldrake, which is rmuldrake. Right, yes, and you'll be back for season 3, towards the back end of season 3, which will all be good. But until next time, everyone, have you got any, just before we go, actually, have you got any final thoughts on the episode, or are you quite happy with everything that's happened so far?
Thoroughly enjoyed it. 7 out of 10. When I first watched Millennium, I thought it was like more of a throwaway episode. But having watched it again, this is probably one of the ones that will stick with me, and not for its wacky comediness or its relentless darkness. It will just sort of, it will stick with me for just as a standout piece of TV, to be fair.
Fantastic. Well, until next time, everyone,
this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.